It will help you to have your Bibles open at the book of Esther. We're going to be going back to the beginning of chapter 5, but don't worry, we're not going to work all our way through 5, 6 and 7 this evening. But you'll see the reason for our doing that. Queen Esther wasn't just a pretty face. We know that she was that. We know that she was the most beautiful of all the women in the empire. But she was also shrewd. She was intelligent. She was resourceful. And in our passage this evening, what we see is Esther's carefully laid plans to appeal to King Xerxes. We're going to call him King Xerxes because saying Ahasuerus every time is not as easy as saying Xerxes. It's the same person in history, Xerxes the First. And what we're going to look at is her carefully laid plans to appeal to him for the deliverance of the Jewish people as those plans come to a crescendo. Haman, the enemy of God's people, we'll see, is brought down. But what I want us to learn as we work our way through this familiar story is that behind and underneath all of the careful and brave work that Esther does is the sovereign hand of God. As she worked, so God was at work in her circumstances. So let's dwell for a moment on the complexity and the brilliance of Esther's plan. Look with me at chapter 5 and we pick it up at verse 1. We're told on the third day Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. So the first thing we need to grasp here is that Esther literally put her life on the line to get this plan started. She had to get an audience with the king, but it was a capital offence to approach the king without first being invited or summoned to do so. And if the king was in a good mood, he extended the scepter to you, and that was fine. And on this occasion, he extended the scepter to Esther. And now the king knew that Esther had something very important on her mind. Something very important to ask. Otherwise, why would she have risked her life in this way? So in verse 3 he says, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom." Now put yourself for a moment in Esther's shoes. You can imagine the enormous sense of relief that she felt. And it would have been very tempting for her at this moment to blurt out, "O king, please deliver the Jews from this edict for our destruction." After all, the king had promised to grant her request. But Esther knew that to ask at this point would have been a disaster. As we know, Haman, the man who wrote the edict, the man who convinced the king to write the edict, was in the king's good books. He was a trusted advisor, and the king, of course, himself had given permission, even though he didn't know the details. Remember that Haman also had promised an enormous amount of money to the king in order to effect this plan. If you look at chapter 3 and verse 9, Haman says to the king, "If it please the king, let it be decreed that they, the Jewish people, be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who handle the king's business." Now, estimates vary, but 10,000 talents is 60 million days of work. 60 million days of labor. So we're talking millions and millions of pounds in modern terms. And Esther knows all of this. And she realizes to make her request at this point might embarrass the king. It might put him into an awkward position. Also, if she showed her cards at this point, she would have to reveal her true identity and the fact that she'd hidden that from the king. And as we know from our studies so far, Xerxes was a proud man. Showing him up wasn't likely to go down very well. And if he were to get angry and lose it at this point, he might choose to depose Esther just as he'd deposed Vashti before her. So Esther stayed calm and collected. She didn't let herself get carried away by the rush of her initial success. So verse 4 she says, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Now, of course, the king couldn't turn down this request. It was so reasonable, but it also made him more curious. He knew Esther hadn't risked his life just for a date with him, even though he was proud and thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. So he agreed to this invitation, and he and Haman went to the banquet. And at the banquet, verse 6 of chapter 5, he asks her again, "What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." And at this point, Esther starts to answer, and then she holds back. If you look at verse 7, "My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." Now, why did she hesitate? This was the second time the king had promised to grant her request. Well, of course, we can't be sure. Maybe she sensed that something wasn't quite right. Maybe it was part of her plan all along. But notice how she gets the king to implicitly agree with a number of things by promising to come to the second banquet. First of all, that he regards her with favor. Secondly, that he is pleased with her. And thirdly, that he will grant her request on that occasion. And now we come forward to chapter 7. This is the second banquet, and they're drinking wine together, and the king is dying of curiosity. He just has to know what's on Esther's mind. So we're told at the beginning of chapter 7, the king and Haman went in to feast with the queen. And as they were drinking, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, and it shall be fulfilled." And notice how carefully chosen Esther's words are in verses 3 and 4. "Then Queen Esther answered, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we've been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we'd been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent. For our affliction is not to be compared with the loss of the king.'" Now think with me what she's saying here. "If I have found favor with you..." So she's linking herself with the king. She's reminding him that you chose me. "When I am honored," says Esther, "you are honored. When I am attacked, you are attacked." And then she follows it up with, "If it pleases you." She knows this guy's got a massive ego, and she's constantly pandering to it. "Grant me my life and the life of my people. We're going to be annihilated. There's a plot to destroy me," she's saying. And then, "If this was anything less than life or death," she says, "I wouldn't bother you with it." So she plays her cards perfectly, and the king is angry. He's suspicious. He senses treason in the kingdom. And then verse 5, King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is he who has dared to do this?" And then Queen Esther says, "A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman," pointing the finger at him as he's there with his goblet of wine to his lips. The king immediately gets up in a rage, rushes out into the garden. Now, why did he go into the garden? Well, it wasn't to cool down. At this point, Haman's fate is already sealed. The king has already decided that Haman is going to die. The king knew, though, that he had given Haman permission to write this edict in the first place. So as he goes into the garden, I think what's going on is he's buying himself time. He's trying to figure out how he can kill Haman and still save face. But the king's problems are solved for him, because while he's out in the garden, Haman, in his distress, knowing that he's going to be executed, falls on the couch where Esther was sitting. And that, of course, was a capital offense. So we read verse 8, the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine. As Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was, and the king says, will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my house? And as the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. His fate was sealed. Death would be the end for him. And then, of course, we see this wonderful twist, that he ends up being hung on the gallows that he prepared for his mortal enemy, Mordecai. What a brilliant plan. Esther knew the customs of the Persian court, and she carefully manipulated everything to achieve her end, everything to her advantage. What's more, she understood the psychology of the king. She knew his pride. She knew that he was a suspicious man. She knew that he was a violent and vindictive man. And it took nerves of steel to deliver what she said in the precise words at exactly the right moment. Esther was a formidable woman. Now, what is the lesson for us this evening? Is the lesson, wow, Esther's amazing, we all need to be like Esther, let's all get out there and do it. Let's be as brave as Esther, and let's be as clever as Esther. No, that is not the lesson that we're to draw from these things, even though we rightly admire what we see in this woman. Some of you are following the blog that we're working through in Philippians. We'll know that we're now at Philippians chapter 2, verses 12 to 13. Where Paul is urging his Christian friends to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. You work and God works. And when you look at this story more closely, you see that underneath Esther's plan is God's plan. Esther worked, but God was already working all things out for the good of Esther and his chosen people. Now, all of us have plans in life. Plans for our careers, plans for pensions, plans for finances, plans for relationships, plans for our own spiritual growth. And we're all working these out where God has placed us. It might be in our workplace, in school, in university, it might be in our marriage and family, it may be here in the church. But underneath our plans and our work are God's plans and God's work. And knowing that and being able to rest in that should give every Christian believer a unique perspective on life. So I want us to look at this story more carefully and see just how God was at work. Now, as I've said before, my inspiration for the series comes from a number of places. So credit where credit is due. First of all, a series preached on this book by Tim Keller, who I'm sure many of you will know or have heard of. Secondly, a series preached by a pastor called Andrew Siegenthaler, who has very kindly given me permission to use his material, and I'm very much indebted to him. When I wrote to him to ask his permission, he came back and he said to me, oh yes, of course you can use this. I have never had an original thought in my life. And I thought, great, there's more than one of us. And then the other thing that I mentioned way back then was a commentary by a man called Ian Duguid, which I would commend to you to get yourself and to read. He's the one that says that we should see the humor interlaced throughout this story of Esther. So let's look at the lessons that we can learn for our own plans and our own works from this story. And the first thing is this: we should plan and work, but remember God's providence. We should plan and work, but remember God's providence. So what made Esther's plan work? It was a brilliant plan. She carried it out extremely well, but it worked because God was present, because God was working out everything at a very crucial turning point. Think with me for a moment. What was it that inclined King Xerxes to look at the Jewish people with favor and at Haman with disfavor at this second banquet? It's something that Esther had absolutely nothing to do with. Now let me explain, let me show you. The Old Testament scholar Karen Jobes has written a commentary on this book of Esther. And in it she analyzes the literary structure of the book. She shows that Esther is written in a series of corresponding scenes that act as brackets around one central scene, which is the turning point of the book. Now she shows that the central scene is chapter 6 and verse 1, where we read these words, and Jonathan alluded to this last week. On that night, the king could not sleep. And what happened when the king couldn't sleep? Well, he asked for the records of his reign to be read to him. And as he listened, he was reminded of an incident that happened 5 years before, where this man called Mordecai the Jew had uncovered a plot against him. But at that time, Mordecai's service to the king had not been rewarded. And that led, as we know, for the king to call for Mordecai to be honored and rewarded. And because that was fresh in the king's mind at this second banquet, he turns his favor toward Esther and the Jews and away from Haman at that crucial moment. So the king's insomnia was the turning point for the deliverance of the Jewish people. Not Esther's plan, not Esther's actions. Who kept the king awake? The Lord did. Was Esther's plan a good plan? Was her work diligent and important? Yes, of course it was. But who worked everything out for the deliverance of his people? God did. And he didn't use a miracle. He used something very ordinary. The insomnia of a king. Something that Esther had absolutely nothing to do with. In other words, God's providence, his sovereign working in the ordinary circumstances of life, is what turned the tide for Esther's and the Jews and against Haman. Now God has given each of us various callings. I tried to write down some of mine earlier this afternoon. I'm a husband. I'm a father. I'm a grandfather. I'm a son. I'm a brother. I'm a pastor. I almost forgot that. I'm a friend. God has given each of us various callings. And we fulfill those callings by making plans. And by working out those plans. And sometimes by taking risks. And our plans and our work are very important. Just like Esther's plan was very important. But you see, God governs. God overrules in our daily lives. His providence is always working in your life and in my life. Proverbs 16 and verse 9 says this, "The heart of a man plans his way, but the Lord establishes or determines his steps." Now that truth should fill us with gratitude and joy, especially when we take the time to look back on our lives and reflect on the turning points, the significant events, and realize that none of it was by chance. Rather, those key points were the work of our Father in heaven who loves us and works for our ultimate blessing and good, even through those things that we look back on and outwardly it seems such a disaster, such a hard thing to live through. Yet we look back and we see that God was in it and God was working. And here we are today, still standing and still following Jesus. It's also a timely reminder to keep our eyes open for the work of God in our lives. And I know in the heat of the moment, that's a hard thing to do. In the heat of the moment and the stress of whatever's going on, it's very difficult to step back and say, "Now, Lord, what are you doing here?" But God is working, always. And it's sometimes good to have a spouse or a friend who reminds you of that. Not in an unkind way, in a gentle way. It can be unkind to sort of say, "Well, you know, the Lord must be teaching you something." When the person is on their knees in tears in front of you, don't do that. That's not good. That's not good care for your friends or your family. So the first thing is we must plan and work, but remember God's providence. The second thing is this, we must plan and work, but remember God's promises. What made Esther's brilliant plan work? Well, it worked because of God's providence, and it worked because God is faithful to his promises. Esther's plan here was to take Haman down. Haman was a powerful man in the kingdom. He had the king's ear. But Esther had something that Haman didn't have. She had a promise. A promise that God gave. A covenant promise that was given to Abraham. Remember back in Genesis 12, God promised that those who bless Abraham and his offspring will be blessed. But those who curse Abraham and his offspring will be cursed. Now what had Haman done? Haman had cursed Abraham's offspring. And he now faces the consequence. He now falls under the curse. Another way of putting that is like this. Haman's downfall was certain. Even before Esther hatched her plan. The blessing and the deliverance of God's people were certain even before Esther made her plan and started to work it out, because the Lord is faithful to all his promises. Now, we don't know how our plans will work out, but we do know God's promises never fail. God's promises can be trusted. Now, did Esther read Genesis 12 during her quiet time that morning? Did she know this promise from Genesis 12? Well, we're not told. But you know, the writer gives us some interesting hints. Remember, at first, Esther didn't want to risk going to the king when Mordecai asked her. Mordecai told her about the edict and said to her, "Now look, Esther, you need to go and talk to the king about this." And Esther's initial response was, "No way." And we understood as we opened up that story that for 5 years she'd hidden her identity as a believer in God so that she could enjoy this life of safety and comfort in the palace. We understood, and we still understand, that she wasn't a spiritual giant. She'd made lots of mistakes and lots of compromises. Her faith was not strong, rather it was weak. But remember what Mordecai said to her in chapter 4 and verse 14. "If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place." Now, how could Mordecai say that? That deliverance will rise. Well, he must have been thinking about this promise to Abraham and Israel, a promise that God had made. And from that moment, Esther, hearing those words, holds on to them and moves forward. Before Mordecai spoke to her, she's paralyzed by fear, but the hope of God's promise enables her to move forward in faith and action. Many of the plans that we make in life are often in response to crises. One day we're just coasting along, life is great, and then the crisis hits. And that crisis can take many forms. It could be that we're hit financially. It could be the breakdown of a relationship. It could be our own emotional breakdown. It could be physical illness. It could be a spiritual crisis. Very often it's a combination of those things. So what do? We start to plan. How am I going to deal with this crisis? How am I going to get through this? How am I going to work this out? And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. We have to plan. But listen, whatever steps you think you need to make in the crisis that you're facing at the moment, your hope ultimately has to be in the promises of God. Because his promises make our future certain. And the Bible is full of them. Find them, claim them for yourself, and move forward in faith as God gives them to you. In my 20 plus years as a pastor, I've seen Christians face crises in different ways. But the thing that always blows me away is when someone contacts me or comes to see me when they're in crisis, and they're not coming to ask for my advice. They don't want my wisdom, such as it is. They're not wondering what to do. But they come to me, or they email me, or they text or message me, and they say to me, "Wes, listen to this promise that the Lord has given me." And then they quote the verse, "This present suffering is not worthy to be compared to the glory that will be revealed in us." Or this one, weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. Or this one, Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And when that happens, two things come into my mind. First of all, if this continues, I'll be out of a job. Do you ever think like that? Because there's nothing else for me to say or do. Because the real pastor of the church, the Lord Jesus Christ, has spoken into this person's life, to this brother or sister, and you don't need me if Jesus is caring for you. And the second thought is this: I'm so encouraged when I see the great and precious promises of God giving clarity and hope for the future in the life of an individual. I'm blessed by God reminding me of his care for each one of his children. So, we must plan and work and remember God's providence. We must plan and work and remember God's promises. Then thirdly and finally, we must plan and work and rejoice in God's favor. What made this brilliant plan of Esther's work? This plan she carried out so well, it worked because Esther found favor with God. Humanly speaking, the success of Esther's plan depended on the favor of King Xerxes. You notice that twice she addresses him like this: if the king regards me with favor, if I have found favor with the king. Humanly speaking, everything depended on how the king regarded Esther. And that meant that what she had to do was make herself appear before him as favorably as possible. So remember, beginning of chapter 5, she took care of her appearance. We know that she'd been fasting, but she didn't let herself go to rack and ruin. She appeared before the king in her royal robes. And then she prepared a couple of banquets. And over throughout the process, she defers to the king. If it pleases you, I wouldn't have bothered you with this, but... In other words, she tries to remind the king in subtle ways why she stood out from all the other women when he chose her as the queen. Esther was the ideal Persian woman, absolutely beautiful and deferential. And it didn't matter what she cooked like, because they'd folks in the kitchen for that. And it was through those things that she sought the king's favor. Now think about it from Esther's perspective for a moment. That's hard work, isn't it? It must have been exhausting emotionally. I've got to look my absolute best all the time when I'm in the king's presence. I've got to say the right thing and do the right thing and not in any way step out of line in order to please the king so that he will favor me. It's exhausting. And in that, there's a very important spiritual lesson. Because we often approach God the way Esther approached Xerxes. We think we have to find favor in God's sight in order to be blessed. So we compile our performance lists, our morality checks, our religious good works, our ethical deeds, our keeping of the law, and we hope that by doing all of these things, God will look favorably upon us. Does that sound familiar to you? Well, perhaps you don't agree. Perhaps you're thinking, well, no, I never think like that. Well, let's do a little thought experiment. You're answering for yourself. No hands up. I'm not going to be asking you to give the answer. Question number one. When things go wrong, when your plans fail, what's your first thought? If you say, why is God doing this to me? Why is God punishing me? What can I do to make it up to him? What are you doing? You're treating God the same way Esther treated Xerxes. And guess what? That's exhausting. Second question. What happens when things go well? And all your plans come together. And everybody looks on you and say, wow, I wish I was in your place. How do you react? Well, if you stand tall and think, well, I must be living right. God's blessing me, then you think that God is like King Xerxes. That he's always looking at you with a suspicious eye. That he's always saying to you, convince me that you deserve it. But of course, this is the truth. We don't deserve it. You are a moral and spiritual disaster. Just like Esther was, and just like I am. And our favor in God's sight does not depend on us. It depends on Jesus Christ. He is the one who found favor in God's sight by his life of perfect obedience. And that means that your destiny and my destiny and your success and my success is bound up in the work of Jesus Christ. A perfect, finished, final work. And you don't need me to tell you that it's exhausting trying to win God's favor all the time so that you'll be successful. But when you realize that you already have his favor through his son Jesus Christ, then you can rest in the fact that it doesn't really matter how your plans work out. And that helps you to be humble when you're successful and God blesses you. And it helps you to have peace when things go sideways and plans fail. Many of you will have heard of Elizabeth Elliot. One of the many books she wrote is called Keep a Quiet Heart. And she talks about the first time that she got to hold a copy of the New Testament translated into the language of the Awka Indians. Many of you will know her story. She and her husband Jim were called to go to South America. They were missionaries. Their job or their desire was to translate the Bible into the language of a primitive tribe. And as they made contact with this tribe, the Awkas, Jim, her husband, and three other missionary men were murdered. Now Elizabeth stayed for a few more years. She continued to do language work in order to see the Bible translated. But for various reasons, all of her language work, all of her efforts came to nothing. Her plan was not a success. It was a failure. Yet one day, there in her hands, years later, a copy of the New Testament was in her possession. The fruit of someone else's labor, not her labor. And this is what she wrote. The complete futility, humanly speaking, of all the language work I did, which for various reasons all came to nothing, was a deep lesson in the supremacy of Christ. Whom had I set out to serve? May he not do as he willed then with his servants and with that servant's work? Is anything offered to Christ ever wasted? Now, why was she able to say that? Why was she able to see her favor not as God's frown, but as a far greater success, as a part of his grand sovereign plan for his own glory? Because she knew that it all rested on Jesus Christ and not on her performance. So plan and work, but remember God's providence. Plan and work, but remember God's promises. Plan and work, knowing that the favor of God through his son Jesus Christ is the most important thing in your life. And that will not change. And when that sinks in, no matter how your plans work out, you can live with peace and joy in the midst of a storm. So what a brilliant and daring plan Esther had. And we should admire her for it. But of course, the real hero is the Lord, who was working behind the scenes through his providence, his promises, and his gracious favor. And the same Lord Jesus Christ is working behind the scenes in your life and in my life, and we can trust him every day. Let's continue to do that as we lean upon him.